As I've already noted in terms of two seminars that come before the lecture, we're now in that phase which very much brings us throughout the 20th century, which is the rise of the magazine market. And we've entitled this Hearth and Home for specific reasons, because the main audiences in so many ways for early magazines, and arguably even today, were both children and women. Magazine journalism as a form is still a relatively neglected area of study. Key press histories, such as Curran and Seaton's Power Without Responsibility, actually have very little to say on the subject of magazine journalism. And yet, as any media job advert section in the pages of the quality press and newspapers will reveal, magazines are major employers of journalists. From the specialist magazines to the generalist ones, they are voracious users of journalistic skills, and it's highly likely that at least 20%, possibly more, of the folks sitting in this room will end up doing some work for magazines, either online or otherwise. In fact, the magazine market has been a significant employer of journalists throughout the 20th century and still for the first two decades of the 21st century. Today, though, I want to concentrate primarily on the changing nature of the magazine market in the first 50 years or so of the 20th century. We'll explore why demand for reading material developed, and also examine how the titles and the contents of these magazines altered to change and reflect the changing nature of the marketplace. Because as is always the case, and I've hopefully made clear over the last few weeks, one of the key elements about any form of journalism is for it to succeed and thrive, at least in a capitalist environment, it needs to sell. It needs to actually be successful and sell copies. If magazines don't sell copies, they fold. Hence the demise of FHM and a lot of other supposedly hugely successful magazines in the latter part of the 20th century, which now have kind of been consigned to oblivion. What I also want to focus on in particular is the burgeoning market for magazines in the sectors of both children's magazines and women's magazines. We look upon the changing nature of the content of those magazines, and also how women's magazines in particular had massive importance from the middle of the 1920s, arguably to the present day. Certainly if you consider the aforementioned FHM, which in February 2000 sold nearly 750,000 copies on a monthly basis, and then compare that with the sales of Woman, Woman's Own, and Woman's Weekly, each of those have a weekly sale in excess of 500,000, you can actually see where the numbers actually are in terms of magazine structure. But let's commence by actually examining what actually brought about this whole notion of a magazine market. Now, some have argued that it was the extension of literacy through the Education Acts of 1870, 1880, and 1891 that prompted the development of a market for light reading. This was a market that magazines were able to satisfy. Nothing too complex, nothing too dense or problematic or intellectually disturbing, but basically just light escapist reading. And contemporary critics of the late Victorian and early Edwardian eras often blamed Forster's 1870 Education Act, which technically brought elementary education within the reach of every child in the country, for the development of bad reading tastes. The writer Joseph Ackland, who wrote a work entitled Elementary Education and the Decay of Literature in 1894, noted that the intellectual faculties of the bulk of the nation were too long in bondage. It shall not cause any wonder, he said, that when the shackles of ignorance were struck off, there was a rush to the fields of fancy and pleasure. George Gissing, in a novel that he wrote about the publishing world entitled New Grub Street, suggested that the publishing industry in the 1890s was creating titles which catered for a vast readership whom he described as a quarter educated. The novel New Grub Street actually refers to a fictional magazine which he actually referred to as Chit Chat. Chit Chat, he explained, was aimed at young men and women who could just read, but actually they were incapable of any sustained attention. Actually concentrating on things for more than 30 seconds would be beyond them. Okay? What a pity they just can't connect with the rest of the world. And Chit Chat itself actually sounds a bit like a thinly disguised version of Titbits, which was first published in 1881. Titbits was a snippet paper. It was filled with easy-to-read trivia and useless information. The editor of Titbits described their intentions in the first issue as follows. The business of the conductors of Titbits will be like that of the dentist, an organised system of extracting. Any person who takes in Titbits for 3 months will at the end of that time be an entertaining companion, as he will then have at his command a stock of smart sayings and a fund of anecdotes which will make him society agreeable. So it's really striking that chord of using the magazine as a way of improving oneself, of actually knowing the gossip, knowing a bit about other sort of areas. Knowing a bit or a little about a lot is a way in which you can actually have something to chat about with your friends and colleagues and workmates. Accordingly, Titbits was both praised as a unique path towards edifying the masses, and it was criticised as symbolising the decline of British journalism. Nevertheless, by 1888, it was selling an average of 350,000 copies a week. Inevitably, rival publishers noted the success of Titbits and sought to produce alternative titles. Pearson and Harmsworth, later Northcliffe Press, produced Pearson's Weekly in 1890, and Answers to Correspondence was also a similar type of magazine. The competition between the rival papers and the rival magazines was great, and there were a number of ingenious prize competitions that were developed to boost circulations. One of the most curious was actually launched by the magazine Answers to Correspondence, in which Harmsworth, the publishers, offered a somewhat macabre insurance scheme to their readers. If you were injured in a railway accident while carrying a copy of Answers to Correspondence, you would be paid £1,000. During a flu epidemic, the rival title Pearson's Weekly was also sprayed with eucalyptus oil as a preventative. So again, you've got two issues there, or two editions, two techniques being used, very much to tap into people's avarice, people's sense of protection, a whole variety of other elements as well. And also, if you're killed in a railway accident, where were the majority of people actually reading these magazines? At railway stations, commuting, and so on and so forth. Just a few seconds. That's a quote that I just actually sort of focused on in terms of Titbits. And this is at the heart, I feel, of the whole magazine success scenario. Now, in addition to that, if we look at Harmsworth's press's growth through the 20th century, by 1909, the company was publishing nearly 50 titles, which collectively sold over 8.5 million copies. Harmsworth's firm, the Amalgamated Press, also founded boys' papers such as Wonder and Marvel, which introduced characters like Sexton Blake Detective. And in addition to this, there was a magazine market established for women, with titles such as Forget-Me-Not in 1891, Women's Weekly in 1911, which is still going strong, and as I mentioned, over 100 years later, has a weekly sale of over 500,000. Harmsworth would target magazines to specific audiences in a way that hadn't been done before. Changing occupational trends would prompt many proprietors to develop titles which featured characters that would appeal to certain women, such as mill workers, shop assistants, domestic servants. There was a growth of employment which was moving beyond the sort of Downton Abbey era into an era where women were going out and working in the workplace and wanted something to entertain themselves with, and so on. Advertising was used to raise the profile of all their titles strategically, and again, these adverts were situated on boards at railway stations and elsewhere in local town centres. publicity gimmicks were common. One of the main innovations of the Harmsworth Company, which was opposed by news agents at the time, was to start a serial in one newspaper and magazine and continuing it in another, thereby increasing sales but also increasing complaints to the news agents by irate customers. And clearly by the early years of the 20th century, there was a burgeoning magazine industry in Britain. Some of the figures. 50,000 different periodicals were published in Britain by 1900. By 1914, there were over 200 publishers of weekly and monthly periodicals in Britain as well, start of the Great War. Certainly there was a need for a literate readership for such a lucrative market to be present. Yet, as we've noted, even before 1870, there was a considerable population of literate working-class individuals within Britain, but it was really only at the turn of the 20th century that mass magazine sales became a striking aspect of British journalism, as opposed to newspapers, the provincial press, and others. So why was that? Well, according to the writer Roberts, in his account of growing up in Victorian Salford, the magazine's vast increases in circulation didn't actually come through literary content. They were based on the introduction of spectacular competitions. They offered readers dazzling cash prizes for life. They offered a range of other elements that worked through in terms of how you can improve yourself. You had pensions for life being offered. And undoubtedly, the growth of the magazine market had much to do with marketing and advertising. However, in order to do that effectively, you need to have a mass readership who have some disposable income. We talked about this last week with respect to sport. And by the early part of the 20th century, many British working class families were relatively comfortable financially. As the historian Ross McNoble noted, British wages did permit more or less anything that made up working class pastimes. The development of organised hobbies, mass sport, popular betting, a modest domesticity, and the communication of much working class entertainment were all areas that could be covered in magazines and developed through their readerships and so on. And declining family size also meant that more disposable income could be spent on younger family members, which clearly opened up the possibilities of the children's magazine market. Prior to the First World War, the majority of children's magazines were actually targeted at boys. There were titles such as The Boy's Own Paper, Young England, Chums, and The Captain. All those titles were very much middle class in orientation. They were aimed primarily at boys between about 10 and 15 years of age. They celebrated things like public schools, running articles on the history of the public schools, the customs of those public schools, and also the public school spirit. So hyper-patriotic, you might well say. They pursued the cult of athleticism, as it's referred to, supported by the public schools. And the celebration of amateur sport was a recurring feature. Magazines such as Chums often contained detailed information about sporting techniques, especially regarding cricket and athletics. Up until the second half of the 20th century, there was actually very little reading material available for the budding sportsman, even less about technique. So if you liked cricket, or if you liked track and field games, where could you actually go to find out information about your particular favourite sport? Answer, magazines that would be developed to that. And a keen youngster would often seek out articles in magazines that related to football, rugby, and so on. Major components of the pre-war magazines, however, were tales of daring do, perfected by writers such as G.A. Henty. Chums actually set its stories, we would regard them as comic strips now, sequential storytelling and so on. These stories were set on the frontiers of the empire. They would take a strong pro-empire stand, expounding on the virtues of British pluck. And middle-class manliness was defined on the pages of these magazines in terms of tenacity, in terms of daring, in terms of moral decisiveness. If you actually compare and contrast the passion that's developed with respect to magazines at the start of the 20th century with the equivalent in terms of Marvel and DC these days, producing Iranian superheroes, in terms of Miss Marvel, wide-ranging transgendered individuals, etc., maybe you're also getting a reflection of elements of society and so on. But this whole creation of middle-class manliness was again key in terms of the magazine and how they were operating, etc. It's a line that comes from the writer Robert MacDonald in terms of this whole essence of what the magazine was aimed at and so on. Chum set its stories on the frontiers of the empire. It took a strong pro-empire stand. The language of good behaviour was borrowed from the sports field. Playing the game, knowing and obeying the conventions of good form, usefulness and loyalty. Was this brainwashing? Well, arguably, could be, seen as an element of that. MacDonald there talks about glory, honour and sacrifice, the supreme values of an ancient race. The notion of the mass slaughter that was occurring 100 years ago from now, we were still in the middle of the Battle of the Somme, actually. It still had a few months to actually go before the big push was taking place. And the captain and chums were quite explicit in their opinions. They regretted professionalism in sport. They celebrated the tall, clean-limbed, athletic amateur above the bullet-headed, bull-necked professional. Writers who were employed on such magazines clearly felt that they were charged with the most responsible task, training the future generation of citizens and addressing some of the central issues of the day. Issues relating to the nature of morality, the possibility of decadence, and the duty of patriotism. Following the First World War, the children's magazine market expanded and more girl titles began to appear, titles such as School Friend, Schoolgirl's Own, Schoolgirls Weekly, and Crystal. But the big five stories, etc., were primarily owned by the Dundee publisher D.C. Thompson, probably better known these days for producing The Beano, which was first published in 1938. The other big five sellers were Adventure, The Rover, The Wizard, The Skipper, and The Hotspur. And according to Ross McKibben, a majority of boys of all ages and in all kinds of schools would read comics. Wizard alone was read by half of all grammar school boys and two-thirds of senior school boys. A quarter of the time girls spent reading magazines was devoted to the boys' comics, despite the fact that they seemed to make no concession to girl readers. Many children would read more than one magazine. In a 1930s London survey, over 50% of those asked read three or more magazines a week, and of that number, 30% read six or more. As I said, in an era pre-social media, pre-screen-based culture and so on, the comic magazine was one of the best ways of actually providing cheap, affordable entertainment. Multiple reading, as I've just described, was only really possible by elaborate swapping arrangements which helped embed magazine reading still further in the culture of the playground. And today's comic readers are tomorrow's magazine readers. So it makes sense if you're getting building up that whole range of input to get people started as early as possible. The circulation of children's magazines wasn't constant during the interwar period. Between the 1920s and 1930s, there was a slow decline, partly due to competition from the radio. Sales improved significantly during the war, as they did with all forms of literature. But during the 1950s, the traditional magazines suffered first from the success of The Eagle, published by Houlton Press, and then latterly from the American imports and so on. The Eagle was a pictorial comic. It was based on the American model. And America had been doing comics and doing them very well, probably on a serious basis for about 20 or 30 years more than Britain's approach to comics in a number of ways, which again we can talk about and discuss. In terms of the Eagle's success, it effectively reached a high of over 500,000 sales per week from its original founding in 1950. From the late 1950s, the children's magazine market suffered considerably from the growth of television. Unless, of course, it took television on board, just as earlier incarnations had taken aboard radio, and actually started producing material which would have been seen as appropriate for TV fans as well. Some magazines would contain only school-based stories. Magnet, for instance, would introduce the world to Billy Bunter. Magazines such as Wizard would have had six or seven different kinds of stories. At least one would be a school story, one would be a joke page, one would be a competition with prizes. all of the comic magazines tries to obtain their readers by featuring a regular character, like the detective adventure Dixon Hawke in Adventure, or the Wolf of Kabul in The Wizard. So how did these magazines actually work? Well, the editors of magazines would often adopt a confiding intimacy with their readers. The Wizard would feature a page called Step Right Up and Have a Chat with Your Editor. The page actually began, "My dear chums, see the heading? That's the spirit. No hanky-panky. Get right down to bedrock and have a chat. You and I like two pals." Boys' magazines themselves became the subject of a celebrated attack by George Orwell in 1940. Orwell wrote the following. "Their political assumptions are two: nothing ever changes, and foreigners are fun. Their mental world was stuck in 1914. This is Orwell writing in 1940. There was no slump, no unemployment, no trade unions, no strikes, no fascism. The working class were absent except as comic figures or villains. The magazines were full of racial stereotypes. Most whites were good, except, unsurprisingly, the Germans. Blacks and Chinese were the subject of intense ridicule. And the evil Chaz Feng was fond of saying, the white race will learn one day the power of the yellow peril." It's difficult to disagree with Orwell's attack on such magazines, but it's also difficult to measure the impact of such reading material on impressionable minds. A large number of those who actually voted for the first time in 1945 and were brought up reading exactly that kind of reading material actually were responsible for voting in Clement Attlee's Labour government, which was seen as quite a shock, almost as much of a shock as recent presidential elections have actually been. Why would you actually vote out the leader who'd led you through the Second World War, Winston Churchill, if you'd really believed all the rhetoric, all the propaganda that had been put forward to you in terms of comic magazines, the notion of the hero, the plucky British spirit, the winner, and so on? There may well not have been a serious departure from the received ideas, and there may well have been a lack of resentment by the bulk of the electorate of public schools, and equally the whole notion of the success of the comics might be explained by preschool fantasies which were manifested in the pages of the popular boys' and girls' magazines. But it's undeniable that such comic magazines were the staple of the children's magazine market during the first half of the 20th century. Although there were other, more specialist magazines targeted at boys relating to particular sports and hobbies, including the rather unfortunately titled The Boy Fancier, which was actually a magazine for young pigeon enthusiasts. Sadly, no longer with us. So who oversaw the actual production processes for children's magazines, and what did their writing and editing actually entail? Well, consider DC Thompson. As we mentioned, mostly known for the Beano these days, but also titles such as The Wizard, Hotspur, and so on. The editing staff at DC Thompson were well-treated and were closely involved in the overall management of the business. Although the company was non-unionised, morale was high, and the paternalistic nature of the firm guaranteed good wages and job security. If a title failed, the editorial team were transferred to other duties. And some of the Thompson editors actually worked for the company for 50 years or more. However, the company's employees were carefully screened. They needed to be seen as being compatible with the firm, DC Thompson, and its high moral policy. Each applicant for a job at DC Thompson's had to sit a test paper, and as one of its editors noted, the aim of this test paper was to try and find out which way your imagination or your brain or your thoughts tended. On that and your general knowledge as to the world about you, you either got a position or you didn't. The relationship between the writer and the editor at DC Thompson was very close, primarily to ensure that the stories were written to the firm's exact specifications. There's a specific brief that you actually have in terms of what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. All of the writers were freelance, none of them were kept on the staff, and writers were visited by senior editors who provided them with a roster of story ideas for 6 months in advance. The output was quite interesting. One freelance writer claimed to have written 8 million words of fiction during his 8 years of working for the firm. 1 million words of fiction per year. Many of Thompson's writers switched readily from writing the company's children's magazines to producing copy for its equally successful women's magazines, including titles such as The People's Friend. Which brings us neatly round to the women's magazine market. In the 1890s and 1900s, a range of specialist women's magazines began to appear. These were magazines that catered for the sporting interests of ladies of leisure. Titles such as The Lady Cyclist in 1895, and its successor The Wheel Woman of 1897, The Hockey Field of 1910, Ladies Golf in 1912, and The Golfing Gentlewoman of 1914 were all popular in terms of women who clearly were in the upper to upper middle class, upper class bracket, and had time on their hands, time to pursue sporting interests and developments. Both the cycling magazines contained advice, news, information, and interviews, and all of them were intended to instruct the women of England in the art and pastime of cycling, and to be a medium of intercommunication between women who cycle. So it's also setting the scene for another key element of magazine production, which is the relationship between the magazine writers and their readers. Much more intimate, much more connected than what we've seen with respect to newspapers and its readership. Women's magazines expanded in number in the interwar period between 1918 and 1939. Some 60 new titles were launched between 1920 and 1945, the end of the Second World War, many of which had a domestic bias. Titles such as My Little Home, Mother, Woman and Home, and Good Housekeeping were all very popular. The range of women's magazines was extensive and still continues to be so. At the top end, titles such as The Lady, still in existence, and The Queen catered for the aristocracy and the gentry, but were also read by the socially ambitious, as indeed was Vogue and Harper's Bazaar. But a new range of magazines were aimed at the affluent middle class. These were quite expensive monthly magazines, such as Good Housekeeping, which launched in 1922, Women and Home in 1926, My Home and Modern Home in 1928. We're gradually seeing that whole notion of the domestic organiser being reiterated and developed within the magazine market. And the emphasis of many of these new titles was on informing middle-class women how to run a home in changing society where servants were becoming more and more scarce and domestic technology was becoming more important. In our recent article, Catherine Horwood took a close look at Good Housekeeping magazine. Good Housekeeping was an American magazine which launched its own British version in March 1922. It's important to note that it's been born in America right at the heart of the whole consumerist boom, developing that obviously through the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, in which the whole essence of consumerism is it succeeds on the basis of buying things is good. If you want to feel even better, buy even more things. Buy stuff. Women's magazines have often been seen as playing a crucial role in the advancement of the cult of domesticity. Many women's magazines would try to elevate the image of women as homemakers by aiming to dignify what elsewhere could be seen as drudgery. And magazines such as Good Housekeeping tried to do this by raising the status of housework, for instance, to that of a true science. It's the science behind it that really makes it fun. From the 1920s onwards, as the standards of living of many middle-class families would rise, but servants became more difficult to hire, owing to more attractive alternative employment, this meant that a market for such magazines which dealt with the technology was developing rapidly. On the one hand, many women readers were indeed, it seems, thirsty for information about domestic technological advances. On the other hand, the manufacturers of such goods needed to advertise them. They also needed to advertise them in magazines that were likely to attract middle-class women. Good Housekeeping quickly became aware of the attractiveness of adverts in their magazine, and they actually introduced the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval, which was a wonderful way of having a guaranteed refund if any product that was advertised in the pages of Good Housekeeping failed to satisfy. That obviously, to the readership, makes the purchase of goods advertised in that magazine all the more attractive to its readers. It's a money-back guarantee. Great. Win-win. In the early 1920s, the assumption of advertisers in Good Housekeeping was primarily that they were still aiming at women who enjoyed domestic help at home. Labour-saving devices such as the vacuum cleaner were being sold as an aid to the domestic servant rather than to the lady of the house herself. 1923 advert, however, stated that the Hoover is no longer a luxury, it is today a necessity. It frees you and your servants forever from the tyranny of the broom. The tyranny of the broom. As the 1920s progressed, a gradual shift occurred, as adverts increasingly portrayed the housewife using the vacuum cleaner or polishing the furniture in adverts, always looking as though she was thoroughly enjoying the experience. And other magazines also developed which were aimed at the lower working middle class audience. Titles such as Woman's Own in 1932 and Woman in 1937. Now, while these magazines weren't filled with adverts for new domestic technology to the same extent as Good Housekeeping, nevertheless, their stated aim was to enhance the domestic capabilities of their readership. Woman's Own launched itself in 1932 with the following editorial. How do you do? We introduce ourselves and our new weekly for the modern young wife who loves her home. Woman's Own will be a paper with a purpose, a paper thoroughly alive to the altered conditions of the present day. The home paper that makes any girl worth her salt want to be the best housewife ever, and then some. First issue of Woman's Own came with a free gift of a ball of wool, and that set the pattern for subsequent issues. It also contained the first episode of a romantic serial. Featured included the right sort of frock, the elements that you actually need to use to effectively have the right dinner party, and so on. The other element that emerged with respect to this era was the role of the narrative for aspiring developments and so on. And the other element that occurs at the lowest end of the women's magazine scale was what we refer to now as the weekly pulp fiction magazines, although arguably these were targeted at men as well. These were referred to as books, in inverted commas, and they were largely purchased by a broadly working-class female readership. Peg's Paper was the first of them. It actually launched in 1919. And it was the first of many which would focus on a variety of titles such as Red Star, Oracle, and Glamour. Nothing to do with the current incarnation of Glamour. These magazines would be printed on the cheapest paper, and they also would be melodramatically illustrated, containing lurid tales of love, sex, and adventure. The word revenge would appear frequently in the titles of their stories. This type of magazine was totally escapist. It encouraged the readers to escape their domestic situations entirely, rather than to dwell upon them and compare them unfavourably to the ideal homes presented in the pages of Good Housekeeping, for instance. So what can we actually draw from this little exploration of the magazine market over the last 100 or so years? Well, we've really only dwelt upon the broad areas of children's and women's magazines, and there are a lot of other areas we'll talk about, I'll have talks about in terms of seminars. But there are still a number of key points that emerge from this. Firstly, increases in leisure time and disposable income would open up a new market for light reading, especially in the lower middle class and later working class homes. So the market was growing, it was expanding. Some critics were very concerned about this. Again, you might sort of say, try and stop the tide, Mr. Canute. Secondly, the effectiveness of the magazine in conveying particular ideological perspectives needs to be emphasised. Journalists in the production of the boys' magazines or comics, of which George Orwell was a key critic, arguably nevertheless plays an important part in the imperialist education of their avaricious readership. It actually gave the working class or people across the classes insights into what happened in public schools, what sort of the notions were, and certainly did create that whole notion of a construction of reality, masculinity, and so on. Ask your parents or your dads about Roy of the Rovers, Johnny Cougar, Skid Solo, and other elements within that. Thirdly, the focus of the marketplace compels magazines to respond to social and cultural change. Some of the elements which we talked about in Good Housekeeping would not be successful today, even if you pushed it from the perspective of irony. And clearly you need to reflect the growing cultural change and images with respect to that, whether you're producing comic magazines or whether you're producing lifestyle ones. And the relationship with the readers and advertisers could be close, it could be complex. The development of magazines such as Good Housekeeping, which depend on the trust factor, being seen as a logical place to go to for guidance, a reassuring voice in an ever-changing environment in which there is so much pressure to consume conspicuously at all levels. If you can trust one sort of technological element, that's one of the areas. Which magazine today works very much on that? Illustrations of the best computer games to buy, the reviews features that come through. How do you actually sort of believe whether a film critic is actually, you know, on your message if you sort of choose that that's what they want to go and see in this movie, etc. It all hinges on that essence of the relationship between the writer, the journalist, and their readership. It seems, therefore, that magazine journalists could indeed occupy, and do indeed occupy, considerable positions of influence, offering their readers guidance in the way to live their lives. And arguably, journalists involved in the production of titles as diverse as FHM, Loaded, Marie Claire, What PC, Nuts, and so on, were continuing to do the same thing in the later part of the 20th century and in the early part of the 21st century. Those that still succeed probably would say they're still doing so. In other words, they're targeting their readers through the shifting sands of social, cultural, and technological change. And we'll pick that up once again in seminars. Thanks for your time. See you then. Make sure you sign the register as well.